You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk to comedian Hari Kondabolu about political comedy in a divided America.
First, the use of body cam footage from police incidents has become a powerful tool for law enforcement, lawyers, and policymakers. It can also thrust people into the glare of the media spotlight if they're witnesses or victims who end up in body cam footage.
And a new law in the state legislature aims to allow witnesses and victims who appear in body cam footage to seal the video from public inquiries if they're in a place where they expected a certain amount of privacy, like in their home.
Assembly Representative Jesse Kramer from Kewaskum joins us now. He's a Republican representing Wisconsin's 59th Assembly District and is co-sponsor of that bill. Representative Kramer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, could you tell us what was behind your move to co-sponsor this bill?
Well, we started working on this bill almost a year and a half ago now. I had noticed that other states had been addressing the issue of body cameras as it relates to public privacy. Obviously, when police are wearing these cameras, they're on virtually everywhere they go. One of my primary concerns is that anything can be released to the public at any time for any reason, whether it's a police officer being called to your home to take a noisy neighbor complaint, and they're videotaping the inside of your house the entire time they're there. Whether it's a domestic situation in an apartment in the middle of the night, or whether it's even a child trafficking situation, there are certain videos out there that should, just because they are recorded and have been recorded, does not mean that they should be released to the public and show up on YouTube or the 6 p.m. news. So we had two primary reasons for drafting this legislation. First of all, we want to make sure that there is a basic framework in the state that all law enforcement agencies should adhere to. It's a minimal guideline on what should be in your policies as it relates to body cameras.
Right, and can you tell us about what some of those, what things in the bill are?
The first point that we said is you have to have a policy. Pretty common sense, but I was told by some law enforcement agencies that no, not every department would have a policy, and some people have to be told that they have to have a policy. So that's the first thing. Second thing is that every video that is taken must be held for a minimum of 120 days. Now, this is very modest because talking to some smaller agencies, they hold on to everything for 2 years. Some larger agencies like Milwaukee, they hold on to things for at least 130 days. So a minimum 120-day hold on all videos. Now, a preservation order can be asked for from any law enforcement officer, defendant, prosecutor, or court to hold on to any video for longer than that if required.
So you're saying at 120 days, unless that video is actively being used in a case, it would be automatically destroyed?
Correct. It could be automatically destroyed. Now, certain situations that are recorded must be held on indefinitely until a court orders the disposal of that. And those are related to a death or alleged physical injury, custodial arrest, or a search during temporary questioning. All of that video must be held on to indefinitely until a court orders the disposal. So those are certain situations that, or obviously if it's involved in a case. So certain things would be held on to for a longer period of time, but any video like a police officer walking around through his entire shift or driving around through an entire shift doing a couple traffic stops, that wouldn't have to be held for more than 120 days.
And have you heard from people who are not in law enforcement per se that were worried about their privacy if maybe they showed up in a police video?
I have heard from people about this. I haven't talked to any personally yet. I know it has happened in other states. Actually, if you Google on YouTube, you can find out videos that have been posted of people that should never have been posted. So this has occurred, but the potential is there right now that any thief, potential person looking to break into a home can get every home that a police officer has been in that community. Any nosy neighbor can see anything they want to see, and there are obviously compromising situations that shouldn't be out there. One additional thing that we added to this bill, balancing public privacy with public safety, obviously body cameras are an excellent tool both for transparency to the public, but also as a policing tool. And our concern is the balance between that. And what we settled on, obviously there are countless situations that can come up. But what we settled on was that anything that's in a place where there's an expectation of privacy, which has been defined by the courts in the past, so within your home or within your workplace, that's not a public area, that doesn't include malls, doesn't include being pulled over in your vehicle, any place where there's an expectation of privacy, any victim, witness, custodian of a minor, any owner of that property would have, who's pictured in the video or anyone that owns the property, would have to sign off on the release of the video before it would be allowed to be released. And that's in cases where there were the death or alleged physical injury, custodial arrest, and searches and things like that. So obviously, our premise is just because something is a government record doesn't mean that it should be made public. Obviously, a lot of things should be made public and there should be transparency there, but I don't think that you want someone walking into your home this afternoon and recording everything in your home and being able to have someone down the road see the inside of your house 12 hours from now. So this is it's a delicate balance, but I think we've striked a very good compromise here.
You've used the word made public and the premise of maybe a nosy neighbor or a thief who wants to see the inside of a house. But how would the public access those videos? How easy is it as it stands right now?
Right now, anyone can go into any police department and do an open records request on any video for any time of day. I have been told by, we've worked with a number of stakeholders on this bill, the sheriffs, DAs, chiefs associations, Wisconsin Professional Police Association. And that's why it's taken so long, because we've gone through so many iterations of this bill to try and strike a good balance. Right now, 95% of anything that is requested via open records with a body camera video goes out the door. There is a balancing test that law enforcement agencies do to decide if something should go out the door or not, but 95% of the time it goes out the door.
We're talking with Representative Jesse Kremer right now, Republican, representing Wisconsin's Assembly District 59, talking about a new bill that he's co-sponsoring that would let victims and witnesses block body camera releases in some circumstances. And what response have you had so far, particularly from law enforcement?
Well, the police chiefs actually just ran into a lobbyist this morning walking through the building here. She said the chiefs are behind this. They love the fact that this bill is out there. It shows that they are in favor of ensuring that there is privacy with these devices yet. The Sheriff's Association has helped us out, like I said, quite a bit on this. I've met with my local law enforcement office chiefs and sheriffs. They've been very supportive of this piece of legislation. They understand that there should be some sort of policy in place by the state, but we don't want something that's too burdensome. There was another legislator in the building here who had a similar bill, similar but very dissimilar, that was rolled out several months ago, and it was also rolled out last session. And that addressed body cameras, but it also went so far as to say when police officers should turn them on, should turn them off, when they should let people know they're being recorded, things of that nature. And the burden is very difficult and very cumbersome on a law enforcement officer who is in a stressful situation to not only think about how to protect themselves and protect the public, but decide when should I turn my camera on, when should I turn it off, when should I notify people that things are being recorded and items of that nature. This bill does not go that far. This bill just has a basic framework in place, basic policies that must be adhered to, basic protections and privacy that must be upheld so the public has the trust of government and at the same time ensuring that these are still useful tools and can be utilized properly.
Do you have any concerns that the bill could blunt the efficacy of law enforcement and, you know, anyone involved in shedding light on a particular case, a controversial incident, in finding out what exactly happened?
No, I don't, because a court can still order the release of footage. A court could still take a look at this stuff and say, hey, this should go out the door. We actually had we had additional language in this bill initially that even addressed right now in some of our prison system where we have prison guards wearing body cameras. And in jails, people are wearing body cameras. So we had addressed that in the bill, but when we had talked with stakeholders, they said, you know, this stuff can all, first of all, under the balancing test, these things won't be released based on a security concern because you don't want people seeing the inside of a jail, the inside of a prison. However, if the court decides that this should be released, they're going to mandate its release anyway. So we simply didn't need a language there. So a court can still order the release of this video at any time.
Representative Kramer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, ma'am.
Jesse Kramer is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 59th Assembly District, and he joined us today to talk about a bill he's co-sponsoring that would have an impact on how body cam footage is made public, especially for victims and witnesses.
Coming up, comedian Hari Kondabolu is in Wisconsin this week performing. We'll talk to him about political comedy in Trump's America. Stay with us here on Central Time.
The 2016 election was a bitter one that exposed the fault lines in America, but all the antagonism between the press, politicians, and citizens seems to have created plenty of fodder for comedians.
Hari Kondabolu is a stand-up comic and co-host of the podcast Politically Reactive with W. Kamau Bell. His humor focuses on everything from race in America to day-to-day life. Take a listen to his appearance on Conan O'Brien's show a few years back.
I was at a restaurant recently. I was overhearing the conversation at the table next to me. This man was angry that the waiter was speaking Chinese. It should be noted at this point, we were at a Chinese restaurant. If there's one place where a waiter should be allowed to speak Chinese, it's at a Chinese restaurant. Let a waiter speak Chinese at a Chinese restaurant. You don't think it's humiliating enough that he has to pretend sesame chicken is a real Chinese dish? And of course, General Tso's chicken, named after that famous general, Tso, who died valiantly fighting to get the seeds off the chicken. It's the same dish. Why do we pay more for seeds?
Hari Kondabolu will be bringing his humor to Wisconsin when he headlines at Madison's Comedy Club on State in a few days, and he joins us now in studio. Hari, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, I know you're not crazy about being called a political comedian in the age of heightened politics, but even right. Before that, how come?
Well, I feel like, you know, whenever I get called a political comedian, it makes it sound like I'm putting on, like, my political lens, you know, as if, like, that's not something I see immediately. To me, what I observe in the world is just that. They're things I observe in the world. They're observations. I see myself as an observational comic. The first thing I observe often are power dynamics. I see power dynamics very quickly. I mean, that's one of my strengths. So why should that be seen as something that's niched? And also, right, you know, especially in this era, you know, with the Trump in office, I feel like, you know, the job of a comedian is to call out what's happening in the room, call out what's happening in the world. Like, you feel what a crowd is feeling. And I feel like, especially with Trump in office, there's a lot going on in the world. It feels like our country's on fire. It feels almost ridiculous for me to not talk about it, you know? So I don't see it as political. I just see it as, like, my day-to-day.
So has the way you approach comedy, has it changed in the before the election and after the election? Or even the way you see yourself in your role?
No, I still see myself as a comic whose job it is to be funny and to be honest. You know, I think crowds sense when someone's being phony, so it's to be true to myself. I mean, the one thing that has changed during the election is that it's actually made my job a little easier, because I always talked about things I care about, like racism or sexism or homophobia or transphobia or anything involving oppression and power dynamics I like talking about. And before, you'd have to explain some of those things to people, right? And now it's kind of like, what is racism? Oh, it's the thing the president said. What is sexism? It's the thing the president said. What is Islamophobia? It's the thing the president said. It gives us a news peg to actually get into the material. So for me, it actually gives me clearer examples.
So do you feel like you are a comedian who's now playing to audiences who don't like and approve of President Trump, or is there a crossover there where you maybe have to walk a line?
There's definitely crossover, and I think I don't know about walking a line. I mean, I think I'm going to say what I'm going to say based on my reality and my truth. You know, it doesn't mean it's the truth, but it's certainly the thing I believe in. And I think for crowds who are open-minded, even if they disagree, you know, it's humor. It's comedy. I know some people who say, I don't agree with the thing you said, but I still think you're really funny, which still kind of amazes me. Like, nothing? You didn't agree with anything? And you still found it funny? But it's an achievement when you do that. It's what you're supposed to do as a comic. You know, my job isn't to play to the choir. I know the choir's there. Great. How about everybody else? How about the people who are attending but don't agree with what's being said? Well, how do I reach them? I might not reach them. I'm not talking about reaching them politically. I'm talking about reaching them as a comedian. So be clear, explain your points of view, and if it's not funny, then at least you know you put your best foot forward.
Well, do you feel like then, you know, with comedy in a way, do you feel like you're defanging things that, you know, you could get people's back up right away if you said something without an overtone of humor? Whoa, I don't want to hear that. But you in a way, do you give them a spoonful of sugar?
Well, yeah, but it's not just sugar. There is medicine that goes with it,
and
right?
Sugar, right. Yeah.
I mean, I think when I started initially, I certainly thought about how am I going to get this stuff to people? Because it's important for me to say these things. I think my approach now is less that, you know, I don't see it as medicine. You know, it might, you know, there's a difference between how I will perform versus how it's being interpreted or the effect of it. I can't think of the effect in that way. I can't think that this is going to be helping humanity, because then I lose focus of the job. The job is to make people laugh, because if I'm not funny, it doesn't matter what my intent was. It doesn't matter, you know, whether it had a positive spin. I mean, when people start clapping and snapping, which I get more than I think other comics, the snapping in agreement, that's not good. That's not a good show. That means they agreed with me. That means the punchline wasn't strong enough, but they liked the political points. And, you know, I'm not speaking at a rally. I'm a comedian in a comedy club. You know, that is my job.
I know you've said that you came of age post 9/11, and that had a huge impact on who you are and how you see the world. I think that's true for a lot of that 9/11 post 9/11 generation. But can you talk more about that in particular, how it shaped you and how it shaped your comedy?
Sure. I mean, I came of age also because that, you know, I was 19, 20 when that happened. So I was going to be coming of age regardless. But, you know, I grew up in Queens, New York. I was sheltered in diversity, which I didn't realize until I went to college in Maine, which is very different. And I didn't have real strong political views. And after 9/11 happened, you know, one, I'm thinking about my city, the fact it was attacked, but also the fact that, like, people are being detained and deported because they're brown skin, because they have beards, because they're Muslim. I'm seeing people being beaten up around the country. There was hate violence all around the country. I'm seeing things that make me question what it is to be an American and why am I not included in that? And again, being sheltered by diversity, like, I knew rest of the world was different than where I grew up, because rest of the country, as it was depicted on television, like, oh, my community doesn't exist and none of my friends exist. But I don't think I really felt that until after 9/11, where I'm like, oh, we're seen as outsiders in our own country. And that kind of violence and language made me really rethink things, and it made me want to, you know, it made me curious. Like, you know, I'm embarrassed to say that I wasn't as invested in the civil rights movement until it started to affect my community. It's not that I didn't care. I didn't see my place in it. And now I see my place in it. I see civil rights as a living thing that I'm a part of. And though it's embarrassing that I didn't see, you know, like, you know, the idea of black, you know, like the black experience as part of my experience too, as someone who believes in justice and who believes all people should be free, I'm glad as a 19-year-old I figured it out, because I have the rest of my life to contribute to justice.
In a way, you've been tracking this for a long time. You talked about not seeing yourself represented, and I know now as a comedian and someone who's active creating media that you did a documentary about the character on The Simpsons, yeah. Apu, and you watched the show, your friends watched the show, but you didn't, it's not really how you saw yourself and how the world should see you. What did that show get wrong?
Well, I don't know if anybody watches that and thinks to themselves, yes, this is me. A white man with brown paint. Finally, I can relate to something. Yeah, I mean, it was weird. Like I was saying before, like the idea that I grew up in this really diverse setting, the fact that this was our sole representation, every now and then you'd have a bit part, like a stereotypical part in a movie or a television show. But this particular show was the biggest show, especially as a kid. Like it was the show of you know, my youth. I mean, still it's my favorite show.
And there's this one South
there's
Asian
just
character.
One South Asian character who's a convenience store owner, and this is how we existed. And, you know, I talk about it in the film, but, you know, he doesn't actually say thank you, come again many times in the show, but it becomes a catchphrase, even though it's not said very much. Well, it's a catchphrase because people are attracted to saying racist things. People are attracted to saying things that they're not supposed to say, even if they know better. And so that's what, you know, that was the legacy of that show, is that it kind of allowed for a certain kind of racism that might not have been vindictive or mean-spirited. It could be, but it was kind of this friendly, well, I'm just doing a character. And for a generation of us, it's like, oh, again, a reminder that we're not from here. And it's not the fact that Apu alone is the issue. It's the fact that Apu is alone. It's it. There weren't other representations. I'm really proud to live in a, you know, I'm proud to be part of this generation that is kind of almost responding to that era, not necessarily by just making a documentary like I did, but by speaking their truth in many different forums. I mean, that's new and exciting.
We're talking right now with comedian Hari Kondabolu. He'll be headlining shows in Madison's Comedy Club on State starting this weekend. And Hari, we were talking about your politics, and you've been very vocal about your progressive politics. And you were previously on a red state tour, states like Indiana, North Carolina, Missouri. Why'd you decide to go to those places in particular?
They offered me money is the answer. I'm a touring comedian. They offered me money. And also, I booked some of those shows before the election, to be fair.
So it wasn't billed as goes on a red state
tour. No, no. I'm just doing shows for people that want to see comedy. You know, at the end of the day, you know, I've had hateful, mean-spirited, or violent things said to me in really progressive cities. I started in Seattle, and I dealt with all sorts of nonsense at shows. So, you know, I'm not going to say that a place is one thing based on a few incidents. And, you know, often when I go to those shows, there's a lot more love because they're glad that I actually came and that a lot of people might not have.
And just briefly, as we wrap up, just a couple seconds, but you'll be performing in Madison throughout the weekend. And what are you expecting here in Madison, known, I guess, as a liberal hub in a battleground state?
Well, I expect fun shows. I feel like comedy, when it's rough, you know, you work on being your defense, you work on how do I save the show because it's a rough crowd. When you're in a show that feels like a home game, it's offense. It's like, how can I take a joke further? I'm hanging out with a bunch of friends I haven't met yet. So I'm excited about the weekend. There's still some tickets available on Thursday and the late shows on Friday and Saturday.
Hari, thanks so much for coming to the studio.
Thank you.
We talked there with Hari Kondabolu. He joined us in the lead up to his headlining shows at Madison's Comedy Club on State this weekend.
Coming up after the news, our guest says we create data with every click, search, and purchase, and it's being used by more and more corporations and government agencies. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, Mr. Ellenberg goes to Hollywood. We meet a UW math professor who worked as a consultant on the new movie, Gifted.
First, have you ever been cloned? Odds are, probably not. There aren't alternate physical versions of you running around out there. But how about this? Our next guest says there are alternate digital versions of you. Hundreds, maybe. Thousands of them. Mini yous. Based on the data that you create.
Those mini-yous are created by marketers, advertisers, police departments, intelligence agencies, and more. And they can be used to determine what ads you see, whether you're a good candidate for a job or whether you're a terrorist and a valid target for a drone strike.
John Chaney Lippold joins us now. He's assistant professor of American Culture and Digital Studies at the University of Michigan. His new book is We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon.
Well, John, who's out there creating digital versions of you and me?
Well, it's really anybody who can get hands on big amounts of data. So it includes commercial firms, it includes the government. It's, of course, Facebook and Google, but it's also smaller institutions like the Chicago Police Department or potentially even big data researchers at the University of Michigan or the University of Wisconsin.
And how do they put these together?
So it's usually through, I'm going to spare everybody the complexity of the statistical models, but it's usually based on patterns. And the idea of having multiple selves, or I like the idea of a mini-you or mini-me's, is that it doesn't really matter if it's effective or true as long as it's functional and relevant. So in terms of our data, we're producing a bunch and a bunch and a bunch, and if our data seems to match up with that of a woman, even though I'm a man, then they're going to treat me like a woman. Or if my data looks like it's a foreigner, even though I'm a U.S. citizen, they're going to just treat me like a foreigner until proven otherwise.
And this is accumulating a lot of data, whatever they can get their hands on. So when you buy an air conditioner, when you search for a medical condition, look up a sports team, it's taking that. But then it's not just saying, oh, a Green Bay Packer fan. It's merging that with other stuff and making speculative guesses about who I am, right?
It's precisely that. And it's not only that you buy a certain product or search for a certain term or look for a certain score for a team. It's where you did it, where the phone's GPS or where maybe the IP address is that you're logging on to the Internet to search for. It's also what terms you searched before as well as after. It's who's near you, what kind of phones are near you when you make that query. All of that data, not just your own data, but all of the aggregate data that they can get their hands on, they run it through these algorithms and try to make sense of it, not because they know what they're looking for, but because there's a potential pattern that could emerge.
And before we get into what they do with this stuff, it seems like the potential for this, for collecting this data, is expanding. Because when you buy stuff at a store and you use a loyalty account, there's that data. And now there's this Internet of Things where, you know, they can collect data maybe from our refrigerators, our exercise monitoring, wristbands, whatever.
Exactly that. And even something as mundane as a television set, there was a very famous incident a couple of years ago of Samsung had a smart TV that would be like most devices of the Internet of Things, is constantly listening in for a voice command. So by constantly listening in, it's recording more or less everything that's happening in the room. So what they're using is you're taking your mundane conversations and then profiling you according to maybe the fact that you use the word the Caribbean once. They think, okay, this person wants to go to the Caribbean. And so Samsung, after people were actually complaining about the invasion of privacy in one's own home, they said, if you want to have a private conversation, you should go to the other room.
And now, beyond the TVs, there are the Amazon Echo-type things, these household computer things that can monitor just about everything. I've seen jokes online. You know, we used to fear wiretapping, and now we ask the wiretap to order us a pizza. I assume this is going to exponentially increase the amount of data we're putting out there.
It most definitely will. And there's a lot of kind of particularities of this. There's a murder case that happened where somebody was murdered and they had an Alexa, and Amazon desperately didn't want the data from the Alexa to be, you know, open for court, because then everybody would potentially turn their Alexas back in, not because they're going to murder somebody, but because they just think of it as their own technology, even though it's constantly communicating with Amazon servers. But I would also suggest that it's not just when we interact with the computers or the devices themselves, it's how we interact with them. So there's a lot of algorithms that try to do and focus on something called sentiment analysis, which is not just what you're saying, but how you're saying it. Are you sad when you say certain things? Are you happy? Are you using happy words instead of sad words? And all of those will then go and participate in this constitutive profile of who you're then determined to be for that one company that you're talking to at that time.
Talking to John Chaney Lippold, his new book is called We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves. Okay, we've got all this data out there about what we do and how we do it, and maybe our mood, as you were saying, while we were doing it. And now there are digital versions of us that different companies and other organizations have. What can they do with this?
So I guess the very kind of benign thing was they could give you targeted advertisements, which is a lot of the things when I teach this, a lot of my students shrug their shoulders, like, I would love to get more appropriate advertisements instead of just the randomness that we see normally. I would suggest that there's something much more constitutive, and in the book I go into this, because it's about understanding a world that's different than yours, but not being able to really get to the heart of it. So you feel it. You know you're maybe a little bit misidentified, or you know that you're getting a certain kind of content, but you're not really necessarily sure. So who we are online then becomes this unsure entity, and as we've increasingly become more attached to our online selves, that, you know, makes us more personally, any kind of, you know, our real life self, unsighted. But I would also suggest that there's other examples. Like in 2014, Orbitz.com, the travel and hotel portal, they actually figured out that they could use things, basic data, such as what kind of browser you're using or how big your browser was, and say, maybe if you're using a Macintosh browser or a Macintosh operating system that has a really big screen dimension, you might be a graphic designer or you might have a really nice computer, and so thus you're more likely to be able to pay for a higher plane ticket. So they would front load your search queries to show you more expensive tickets than somebody who had maybe a PC or a smaller screen dimension. So it's not just that we're getting targeted content or that the world is looking particularly different, but we actually have less power vis-a-vis these other institutions, and we might end up paying for it.
Now, before we get to more practical ways this could affect us, you have a philosophical concern here. It sounds like that, if I have this right, that there are versions of ourselves out there being traded and sold and used in different ways that we don't have full knowledge of and certainly we have no control over.
Yeah. I really like going back to this one quotation by Louis Brandeis in 1890. And he wrote this very, very, you know, I think wonderful article called The Right to Privacy. And before then, the idea of privacy was a constitutional effect, but not necessarily a right in the fact that we call it the right to privacy like now. And his go-to phrase was that privacy wasn't just shutting off the world from your private space. It is the right to be let alone. And I think about that in terms of philosophy. It's about, are you let alone to be a political subject? Are you let alone to be a social subject? Are you let alone to make decisions for consumer or cultural decisions or religious decisions without something that's predicting your behaviors or trying to navigate you and manipulate you to choose something other than if you didn't have those influences in your life, you would choose otherwise?
An interesting twist is you mentioned earlier that there might be a profile of you, a digital version of you that thinks you're a woman or that you're a different age or something like that, that has something fundamentally wrong. How does that happen, first of all, and what can be the impact of that?
Well, I would invite all of your listeners, if they care to Google, what gender does Google think I am? And this was in a couple years ago. Google made its inferences of age and gender public. So you could go to your Google profile and see what your gender was. And so Google profiled me to be a 65-year-old woman. And that is something that you would normally scoff at, but then you look at actual Google's methodology. What they do is they say, this person searched for these things with these keywords. And because of that, they don't necessarily have the same maybe political positionality as a woman in U.S. society, nor the political positionality of a 65-year-old. But I just behave in a comparable way as a 65-year-old profiled woman, and so it's not necessarily grading to me or misidentifying me, it's more redefining me, and at the more foundational level, it's redefining what we mean when we think of gender and what we mean when we think about of age.
Now this, you write, can have a real-world impact. The National Security Agency has, you write, algorithms to decide if somebody they're tracking online, maybe they don't know exactly who it is a citizen or a foreigner, and different privacy rules apply based on what their algorithm decides.
Yeah, this is something that really took me for a spin. In 2013, with the Snowden documents, they released, or the reporters and Snowden himself released, the document expounding on the PRISM program. This was the program that showed how the NSA was tapping into Facebook, Google, Yahoo, etc. And they figured out that they had access to all of this data, but they weren't able to really understand who was and who was not a citizen, because it's just data, it's just IP addresses. And you can assume online there's no ability to ask for somebody's passport or birth certificate. So what they had to do is redefine a new, what I call, algorithmic citizen that's based not on, you know, what normally is, you know, the identifiers of citizenship, but based on data. And so the document that itself shows how this is done is from a 2009 Eric Holder signed document that says that citizens are people who speak English, who talk to people who are in the United States, who talk to people who are reasonably believed to be a citizen, as well as who don't encrypt their communication. So all of those things have no bearing at all to being a citizen of the U.S., but are what are used to then determine if you are, in the case of the NSA, 51% reasonably believed to be foreign. That allows the NSA to surveil you.
We're talking to John Chaney Lippold, Assistant Professor of American Culture and Digital Studies at the University of Michigan. His new book is We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. When you search for stuff online, when you post on social media, do you worry about how your data is used? Do you try to avoid that, and how do you do that? Do you want to see more protections for people and for their personal data? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're talking about our data, who uses it, and how it shapes our lives. John Chaney Lippold is with us. His new book is called We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about how your information is used? What you post, sure. Where you post it, when you post it, your mood. It sounds like people are figuring out how to assess that when you do stuff online. Have you taken steps to try to separate yourself with this, or are you on the other end of this? Do you work for a company that uses this kind of data one way or another? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Carol is with us in Milwaukee. Carol, hi.
Hi. I work for a company, and we have been they've invested in bit mining for years and years. We have so much data. We can tell people what kind of baby gender they're going to have 9 months before the babies are born. It's really interesting. But we also, it's a retail company, so we also control the price points. We know exactly what price people are willing to pay or won't pay. It's interesting.
And Carol, some people on the other end of this are a little upset by it. You feel okay about the use of this data?
I'm mixed. But like I said, they've been doing this for years and years, way ahead, way before any other companies have been doing it. They were investing 25 years ago in this information.
Carol, thank you so much for calling in with that. John, what do you think? This is a lot more people are doing it now, but this has been evolving for a while.
Yeah, it is a remarkably interesting history if you want to go through it, but I'm not going to bore people with it. I think that there's a larger theoretical issue that I think that the caller just suggested, which is that normally we think of this as an asymmetrical market. People have won Nobel, you know, prizes and other, you know, a lot of, like, in other words, because of this, thinking about what they call of lemon markets or asymmetrical information markets, where a, you know, car seller of a used car lot might know that the carburetor of a car is messed up, but the user doesn't, or the person purchasing it doesn't, until eventually they realize a couple miles out. The idea then about that is that there should be some sort of regulation, or there's some sort of kind of like honesty in how the market works. But as the caller suggested, there's so much data that they can understand your price point, not just your price point, but the price point for you at 8 a.m. is different than the price point for you at 5 a.m. after a whole day of work. And so if we're thinking about power as something that is freedom is just something to be able to spend your money effectively and knowing how your money is going to be actually valued, I think that really puts us in this problematic situation where you're not really sure of what the world is.
Carol, thanks for that call. Another downside people point to, John, of this of our reliance on algorithms, even if we're not using it to get the most money out of the customer as much as they can afford, is that we think of, oh, algorithms, it's numbers, it's unbiased, it's a way to get past human biases, whether it's race or gender or whatever. More and more people are saying, actually, we're just using the math to recreate the same bias again and again.
Yeah, that is something in my research I found over and over and over, because there's a very important quotation in the field that I study, which is there's no such thing as raw data. And that comes to bear when we think about police agencies, such as the Chicago Police Department. A couple years ago, they employed what is now known as predictive policing. And so initially they said, we're going to use a bunch of data to find out which city blocks were high crime at what times, and then, you know, move police cars or police presence to those high crime areas. They then found out, what if we did this not to blocks, but to people? So then they compiled a list of 400 people that had, quote, connections to either victims or assailants of violent crimes. That means that if you're involved in a crime, either as, you know, being the one attacked or if you're the one doing it, if you have a social network that connects you to that person, you then will be put on this list. And then the police department will come to your house and say, we're watching you. Obviously, this is not a, you know, multicultural, multiracial group. It is often the people who are more likely to be policed, which are people of color. And so it just reifies this kind of, you know, anti-black or anti-Latino relationship with the police and then with cops in general. But then the important thing that I think is actually quite funny is there's some writers and programmers at the New Inquiry magazine who did something that instead of just crime statistics, they used it for white crime. White-collar crime. And so they created something called the white-collar crime risk zones that use the same algorithm that instead of finding, you know, petty offenses or more kind of like serious offenses like murder or theft, they looked for white-collar crime like fraud or other things like that.
Talking to John Chaney Lippold. His new book is We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves, How Our Data, How Our Behavior is Assessed by Companies, Police Departments, Intelligence Agencies, the Government, Marketers, you name it, and used to sell things to us and more. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and your thoughts. And John, let's get into, if we don't like this, what can we do about it?
So for me, that's it's a really hard question, and I think it's even harder with the new rollback of FCC regulations that the administration did earlier this month, which more or less lets ISPs have full reign over all of your data. This is importantly different from existing modes of data surveillance and consumer surveillance, because unlike a Google or a Facebook or whatever company who only has a little bit of your data, ISPs have 100% of all data that you send out. And so they have then an incredibly rich tapestry by which they can understand you and more or less profile you accordingly. Strategies then about saying, I want privacy, don't really work, because privacy in its normal form of, like, I don't want anybody to see me, don't function, because you have to use an carrier, you have to use an ISP. So there's a couple people at NYU who have created something called obfuscation, or developed this idea that comes through a plugin called TrackMeNot. And so instead of saying to your ISP who's trying to surveil you, these are all my queries, it adds on to every initial query that you do 6 other queries every 10 seconds, let's say, so that there's no real ability to understand who exactly you are, because of which every real query, there's 6 additional queries to accompany it.
So it's just throwing up, tinfoil, like to foil radar in the old days of aerial warfare. So if I'm a white guy searching online, it might search for African-American-oriented magazines or travel to India or whatever.
Exactly. It's like the I'm Spartacus scene, but they don't die at the end.
Now, on the regulatory side of things, you just said with Internet service providers, things have been dialed back there. Are there regulatory changes that you would like to see happen that might help tip the balance away from the data collectors and to the subjects of the data collection?
I think that the FCC rules that were put in place, which was an opt-in framework, is, I think, the best regulatory framework you can work with. Right now, it's now you have to opt out, and if you don't know the surveillance is going on, you have no ability to really opt out, and also you can't opt out of the thousands of different companies that are doing this every day and the new ones that are being developed every month. So for me, the first and foremost thing is to think about how we can reformulate ideas of data collection and surveillance to an opt-in framework.
Should we own our digital selves to some extent?
I'm hesitant to say that we should own them, because I guess philosophically, to go back to philosophy, I don't agree with that we even own our real selves. I think that we're always kind of intersubjectively related in a very, high theoretical way, that I am me, but I'm also my relationship to my mom. And I don't want to ever kind of efface that just because I'm some, very arrogant person who wants to control everything about my life. I do think we should have control over it. So we should be able to understand exactly how we're treated and exactly how every decision we make has consequences that we might initially not understand.
Now, we see on some pieces of technology a private browsing option of some sort, say. Does that actually do anything?
Sadly, it doesn't. It's mostly just for on your computer, on your desktop or laptop. It just doesn't save any information, and it doesn't do a couple of the, either it doesn't accept cookies or it doesn't allow for some of the tracking mechanisms to work. But much like these companies have been doing this work for decades, they've also found ingenious ways to track you, from what kind of fonts you have in your computer, so they can track you across IP addresses. So if you go to a coffee shop and then you're home, you have the same configuration of your browser, the same system updated, same font, same screen size, same languages installed, that can be used just the same as a cookie or as an IP address to track you.
And briefly, as we wrap up, John, you've been studying this, writing about it, teaching it for quite a while now. Does this affect how you behave in the digital world?
It completely does, but it also is increasingly not, because in a cynical way, I've kind of just given up. But in a tactical way, I know, for example, that my plane tickets will be potentially more expensive if I use a new computer, or my plane tickets or hotel rooms will be more expensive if I use a mobile phone, just because of the way the data is valued and just because of the contemporary patterns that they found that suggest that people who have these data qualities are more likely to pay more.
We'll leave it there for now. John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to John Chaney Lippold. He's an assistant professor of American culture and digital studies at the University of Michigan. His new book is called We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves. You can find out more about the book on the Central Time Facebook page. And while you're there, if you're willing to share, put a little more data into the data sphere about yourself. Tell us what you think about all this. If you've encountered this sort of thing being treated differently, charged different amounts based on the computer or the phone you use. Again, share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. Although it's almost Friday, that is, it's Thursday, which is generally a happy thing, today is bittersweet for us because Central Time and WPR are losing one of our own, producer Marika Suval.
That's right. So we're sad, yet we're happy for Marika, who's moving on to pursue some other passions in her life. Hard to believe that there are other passions in one's life besides public radio.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Marika has them, and she's going after them.
And she worked on Gene Faraca's show here on Earth, and with pretty much all the shows on the Ideas Network as a floating producer, the Joy Cardin show, all of them, Kathleen Dunn show, you name it. She's done some of it. And with the Once Upon a Time Veronica Rickard show. So you go way back working with
Marika. Right. This was the show before Central Time that I hosted. And Marika was the producer on that show. We shared an office and she produced some outstanding shows that both of us still like to look back and kind of go, ah, those were so good. She produced a show with blues musicians Muddy Waters, Carolina Chocolate Drops. She really went after this really difficult to book program with a Chinese dissident artist, Ai Weiwei. And she was able to get a response. So some amazing production. Her good humor will be missed, her hard work, and of course her love of an afternoon chai.
We will miss you, Marika. Thanks for all the work you've done. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time.